This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Linda Wertheimer, in for Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's be frank. Members of Congress will spend part of this fall at home in their districts campaigning. There's an election coming, of course. They will spend the rest of the time back here in Washington debating legislation and also campaigning. There's an election coming. One of the most uncomfortable issues for some Democrats is the issue of tax cuts. The big tax cuts approved during the first term of President Bush's administration expire at the end of this year. Most Democrats, including President Obama, say they want the tax breaks permanently extended, except for the wealthiest 2% of taxpayers. And that is going to spark some debate. NPR's David Wellner continues our series this week on the expiring tax cuts.
A full-blown congressional debate on expiring Bush tax cuts is expected this fall, but some lawmakers have already weighed in on the most controversial issue, whether it makes sense at a time of huge budget deficits to extend those tax cuts for household income that exceeds $250,000.
Here, come to order.
Earlier this summer, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus gaveled in the only congressional hearing held so far on the expiring Bush tax cuts. Baucus originally supported all those cuts, but the Montana Democrat told fellow panel members he thought it now made sense to extend only the tax breaks that benefit the middle class.
With today's budget picture, it's no longer clear that we can afford large tax cuts for the most well-to-do.
While Baucus argued in terms of fiscal responsibility, Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow said it's really a question of fairness.
You know, at a time when people are losing their jobs, working part-time jobs, seeing their wages go down, and the incomes of the wealthiest 400 people in the country have gone up about 400% in the last decade and a half, and their tax rates have been cut in half, for the majority of Americans, that doesn't compute. That is just not fair.
Republicans don't argue it's fair to extend the tax cuts for the wealthiest. Instead, they say small businesses would be hurt should those top cuts expire. Here's the finance panel's top Republican, Chuck Grassley of Iowa.
On my side, we hear small business people loud and clearly. They say they know their taxes are going up. They don't know how high the rates will go.
To drive that point home, Senate Republicans showcased an actual small businessman at a Capitol Hill news conference.
Good afternoon. My name is Craig Fritchie. I'm a Tart Lumber Company out near Dulles Airport. Just here to say a few words about our small business.
Craig Fritchie has not laid off any of the 60 people who work for his lumber company. He also hasn't made enough money in the past couple of years to be taxed in the top income brackets. Still in an interview, Fritchie says Democrats are wrong to let tax cuts expire for any small business that would make that much money.
And they don't realize we're not out buying boats, we're not out buying second homes. We're plowing that money back into the business and creating jobs.
Some economists would agree. Former Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Holtz Eakin told the Finance Committee it was a bad idea to let tax rates go up.
My own research says that if you raise the top rate from 35 to effectively 42%, given all the phase-outs, you're going to lower the probability of a small business hiring by about 18%. And for those who already have people in the payroll, payrolls are going to grow 5% slower than they would otherwise.
But Brookings Institution tax policy expert William Gale says the impact on small business of letting top tax rates rise has been greatly exaggerated.
First, 98% of all small business owners are not in the top two tax categories. Second, even among the people who are in the top two tax categories, most of them earn most of their income from other sources rather than small business income.
Democrats say far from hurting small business, they're trying to get specific tax breaks for such firms extended, and it's Senate Republicans who are standing in the way. President Obama is expected to provide his party further political cover later today by proposing additional business tax incentives. Still, some Democrats wish the president would stop insisting the top tax cuts have to expire. Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly, who represents the country's wealthiest district, notes that 47 of the country's 59 most well-off districts voted for Mr. Obama.
There are voters, and the more some of my colleagues who represent some of those districts fully appreciate who we're talking about, perhaps that will give them pause to consider, I think, a reasonable proposition, which is don't allow those tax cuts to expire at this time.
Because letting tax rates rise even for just the wealthy might not only hurt a fragile economy, it could also take a toll on Democrats like Jerry Connolly at the polls in November. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
When we think taxes, we think income taxes, but there's more. NPR's Tamara Keith calculates one family's total tax burden.
Harlan Milkov and his wife, Tess, met their freshman year of college. Now they're both 26. Both work as engineers. They own a home in Stratford, Connecticut, and they have an 8-month-old son named Ethan. And they were kind enough to let me invade their financial privacy in the name of documenting just how much of their income goes to taxes. Before we sit down with our calculators and spreadsheets, Harlan Milkov takes me out to gather some data. At a nearby gas station. 12.5 gallons later.
So what does it tell us?
It says $44.91, and they don't break out the taxes from that.
Connecticut residents pay 60.3 cents per gallon in state and federal gas taxes. So for the Milkovs, who use about 1,200 gallons a year, that adds up to just over $700.
This looks scary, but it's very organized. Some of it's just tax folders, and then we just have a bunch of receipts.
Milkov spreads tax returns, receipts, and various bills on the dining room table. His wife, Tess, flees to the living room. We tally up state and federal income tax, Social Security, and Medicare taxes using data from their 2009 returns. These taxes, taken out of their paychecks each month, account for more than 3/4 of the Milkov's tax burden. Property tax on their home comes in at just under $5,000. And in Connecticut, they also have to pay property tax on their 2 cars.
Car tax due is $433.84, and Tess's is $395.52. It's like an extra car payment for each car. It comes out pretty close.
Milkov is one of those people who carefully tracks just about every dollar spent.
So we've got some retail items here and major expenses like restaurants, groceries.
And those are all taxed at a 6% sales tax.
With the exception of groceries. So I guess we can exclude that one.
The grand sales tax total for the year is $400. They also pay about $65 a year in alcohol excise taxes. They don't smoke, but if they did, they'd be taxed more than $4 a pack. The Milkovs are going on a couple of short vacations, so we add in hotel and rental car taxes and about $85 worth of taxes on 2 round-trip plane tickets. Then we dig into their phone bills and find yet more taxes.
There's a public safety communication surcharge, county sales tax, state telecom excise tax.
Both the cell phone and home phone bills are about 20% tax. Milkov is annoyed.
It's kind of disgusting.
But an entire year's worth of telecom taxes don't even add up to 1% of the family's tax total. Gerald Pranty, an economist at the Washington-based Tax Foundation, says it's the little taxes that are often the most annoying.
People get very frustrated at taxes that are relatively small compared to big tax. I mean, if you look at this list, everything is chump change compared to this federal income tax.
Pranty is looking at the list of taxes Milkov and I came up with.
Taxes he's bearing directly, this is a pretty comprehensive list.
But he says there are other taxes that people pay indirectly. When the Tax Foundation looks at this larger picture, it finds the average American pays 28% of their income in taxes, though that varies widely depending on income. So how much are the Milkovs paying?
So that was 48.80.
Just over 24%. Plus. When we're all done, Harlan Milkov seems more tired than anything else.
Yeah, it's not fun. I wouldn't recommend it.
To see a chart breaking down all the Milkov's tax expenses, visit NPR.org. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. When President Obama visits Cleveland today, he's visiting a battleground in the 2010 election. His party faces tough races for the Senate and for governor. It's also the location of several tight races in the House.
Democrats go into those fights and others across the country knowing that nationwide surveys show the public turning against them. And in a moment, we'll talk with the president's senior advisor, David Axelrod.
We'll begin with NPR's White House correspondent, Ari Shapiro.
Cleveland is getting it from both directions. 2 weeks ago, House Minority Leader John Boehner of Ohio used the City Club of Cleveland as the backdrop for this economic speech.
You know, I've had enough, and I think the American people have had enough, of politicians in Washington talking about wanting to create jobs as a ploy to get themselves reelected while doing everything possible to prevent jobs from being created here in our country.
He gave a glimpse of what the future holds if Republicans take back the House in November.
Right now, America's employers are afraid to invest in an economy that's stalled by stimulus spending and hamstrung by uncertainty.
That speech apparently got under the White House's skin. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the president chose Cleveland for today's event because it was the site of Boehner's speech.
If you look back at what Congressman Boehner said in that speech, he seemed to lay out a strong predicate for the very same type of decisions that have been made over the past 10 years that got us into this mess.
The meat of the president's speech today is three economic proposals. According to an administration official who previewed the event yesterday, the president will repeat his call for repairing the country's roads, train tracks, and airport runways. He'll describe a proposal to spur growth by increasing tax deductions for American companies that make capital investments. And he'll ask Congress to expand a tax credit for companies doing research and development. Laura Tyson is a member of the president's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. On Sunday, she told CBS's Face the Nation that the emphasis on research and development is not new for this president.
In fact, you know, an important part of the stimulus that people don't talk about is really the support for continuing research and development. That's where U.S. competitiveness lies in high technology industries. We know that the R&D tax credit is an important credit that does affect how much R&D spending business does. And business accounts for something like two-thirds of all R&D spending in the United States.
But she said people hoping for a quick boost in hiring from this policy may be disappointed.
I don't think this is something that has as immediate a job impact as, say, movement on the current tax credits for the unemployed or extending or a payroll tax holiday of some sort. But I think it's very important in terms of job creation over the longer term.
President Obama's practice in all of his recent economic speeches has been to slather the meat of the policy with a thick political gravy. In Milwaukee on Monday, he laid the blame for the country's current economic problems in the lap of the Republican Party.
I mean, think about it. We have tried what they're peddling. We did it for 10 years. We ended up with the worst economy since the 1930s and record deficits to boot.
White House officials have strongly suggested that they don't actually expect Congress to enact these policies before November. Campaign schedules and political gridlock make that nearly impossible. But the message from both parties remains, we can fix this. Just give us another chance. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
Presidential Advisor David Axelrod has been listening with us. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
When we just heard President Obama there, he was delivering the textbook Democratic message this year, don't go back to the past, which Democrats have been repeating all summer. Why do you think it hasn't resonated with voters?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. It's not just our talk about the past isn't our message. It's their message. Pete Sessions, the head of the Republican Campaign Committee, said a few weeks ago that their goal is to go back to the same exact policies that were in place before this president took office. Let's remember, those were the policies that crashed the economy. We lost 4 million jobs in the last 6 months of the last administration. The middle class flatlined for that decade. Special interests ran wild, and these are the very policies that they want to return to. So there's a great stake, but the campaign is about making those stakes clear, and that's what we're going to do.
Although let's be frank here, Mr. Axelrod, what you just said worked very well for you in 2008. But what do you think this administration has done that has caused that not to be resonating with voters now?
Well, I'll tell you what this administration has done is the country was losing 800,000 jobs a year. We've had 8 straight months of private sector job growth. It's not nearly strong enough to repair the damage of 88.5 million jobs lost during this recession, but we're moving in the right direction. The wrong thing to do is to go back to the policies that created the problems in the first place.
Are you surprised to see an ABC News Washington Post poll that shows more people trust Republicans to deal with financial matters than Democrats? It's unusual that Democrats would trail on economic considerations.
Well, Steve, not really. I mean, look, we're the party in power now. We didn't create this problem, but we're the responsible party now. And people are having a very tough time out there. You travel the country, you hear these heartbreaking stories about folks who've lost their jobs and are desperately trying to find new ones, or have lost their homes or their retirement savings. So it's not any wonder that people are frustrated, and it's not any wonder clear that their first impulse is to express that frustration in the way they are in these polls. But we have 8 weeks to focus on the choice. This is not just a referendum on our economic conditions. It's a choice about where we want to go in the future. And where we want to go in the future is to promote growth that lifts the middle class, innovation, investment, the kinds of things the president's talking about today. Where we don't want to go is budget busting, tax cuts for the wealthy, a free rein for the special interests, and cutting the middle class loose to fend for themselves, which was the story of the last decade.
I'm glad you mentioned the tax cuts for the wealthy. President Obama wants those tax cuts to expire. Some Democrats are saying that maybe they should be extended. And in fact, Peter Orszag, who certainly is trusted by the president, he was the president's budget director until a month ago, is writing now that he thinks that those tax cuts for the wealthy should be extended for a couple of years because the economy is just that fragile.
Steve, you ought to read Peter's piece just a little more carefully, because what he said was he would prefer that we extend only the middle class tax cuts, which is what we're fighting for, the tax cuts that for the 97% of American taxpayers. He said we may have to accept tax cuts for upper income in order to pass the tax cut for the middle class. And in fact, the Republican Party is threatening to hold tax cuts for 97% of the American people hostage so that we will pass tax cuts that will disproportionately favor millionaires and billionaires. And that would be all right if we could afford to give everyone a tax cut. But what they're talking about is a $700 billion tax cut over the next 10 years for people who don't need it, weren't asking for it, an average $100,000 tax cut for millionaires. More than half of that tax cut will go to people who are making more than $8 million a year. We simply don't have the money. We can't be borrowing money from foreign entities in order to pay for a tax cut for the wealthiest Americans.
Mr. Axelrod, one other thing. We've just got a few seconds here. Political analyst Charlie Cook reviews the administration so far this way in a recent column, and I'm just quoting here. This is the way that he sees the administration's approach the last couple of years. Quote, President Obama and the Democratic Congress checked the box on the economy with an unpopular stimulus bill and then became obsessed with passing a health care reform package. Is there any thought in the administration, we've just got a few seconds, that you've gotten out of step with the public's concerns on the economy here?
Well, look, we've been working on the economy day in and day out. There's no silver bullet, Steve, but we've been doing things such as passing help for teachers who've been laid off, firefighters, police, so they stay on the job. That's one of the things that John Boehner attacked, extended unemployment insurance. The Republicans tried to block it. We're trying to pass small business tax cuts. The Republicans are blocking it in Congress. So we're working right along on trying to get this economy moving. We would like some cooperation.
Mr. Axelrod, thanks very much.
Great to be with you.
Presidential Advisor David Axelrod. And you can read for yourself the article we discussed by Peter Orszag, the former White House Budget Director on taxes. It's available on Twitter. Find links at Morning Edition and at NPR InScape.